The title of today's program on Inside the Black Box is Seismology on Trial. And to discuss this is our guest, the Karen and John Huff School Chair for the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at Georgia Tech, is Reginald DeRoche. But we're going to call you Reggie during the show, right? Because any self-respecting guy from, Queens would not survive very long being called Reginald. Yes. That's on right. The streets. And we're going to talk about how to engineer things and deal with the fact that earthquakes happen, and a little bit about the very controversial conviction of seven Italian scientists back in October with regard to their failure to properly warn a community about an impending earthquake. That's next up on Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier. The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ledovis, and before we begin, I am joined by a new member of the crack engineering staff here at WREK, Eric Luckner, who's a senior in civil and environmental engineering, correct, Eric?
Yep, that is correct.
Okay, and actually has happened to have taken a class from our guest today, Reggie DeRoche, who is the chair of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at Georgia Tech, and relatively new. When did you start?
I've been chair since May of last year, so a little bit over 6 months. I've been here 14 years.
Okay. So you were here 14 years, and then were promoted to chair, or you?
Yeah, I was. I had other administrative positions prior to being chair. I was associate chair for about 5 years, and I've been here since 1998.
So, but you don't look like you're ready to flee the building. So
it seems to be
agreeing with you. Right?
It's good. I'm enjoying it here.
Right. Great. See, everybody thinks that's a good position, right? Ooh, chair, you're in charge. You get to run things.
It's not as good as it sounds, I tell you.
Trust me. I believe it. It is a position I would not only not be qualified for, but would never want in a million years.
I feel like a PhD in psychology will serve me better than my PhD in engineering.
Yeah, because, dealing with faculty, a lot like herding cats is what I've heard.
That's exactly right.
You know, very bright people, but kind of squirrely. I'm going to stick with squirrely because that's not going to get me into too much trouble. And I'm the squirreliest among them. There's no doubt about it. So now, you actually did most of your degrees in both mechanical and civil engineering, including your PhD in structural engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, correct?
That's correct.
While you hail from Queens, you were actually born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, right?
I was. I came as a baby.
Yeah. So in addition to doing all sorts of what I have no doubt is brilliant research, having published over 200 articles in the general area of earthquake engineering and seismic risk assessment, and given hundreds of presentations in numerous countries, you're actually involved a lot with earthquake issues in the Caribbean, right?
I am. Okay. I traveled to Haiti 12 times since the earthquake. And the first time was right about a week after the earthquake, where they needed a group of people to go down and do what we call rapid building assessments to determine which buildings are safe to reoccupy, which buildings they need to not occupy.
Right.
And so I was there really when things were really bad and there were dead bodies, and it was really a precarious situation.
Yeah, it sounds
seven
awful.
7 days afterwards,
So hopefully we'll talk about this in the broader context of understanding, you know, how to engineer structures and things like that. And then, to some degree, how to deal with the aftermath.
That's
something I guess a lot of people don't think about.
Right.
Certainly, we sometimes fail to teach our engineers that sometimes things don't work.
Right.
What do you do?
Right.
So before we do that, let's begin the program as we often do with...
Science in the News.
And the Science in the News article comes from the December 31st New York Times. It's an article by Jane E. Brody entitled, What Do You Think You Know But Don't About Wise Eating? And Jane thought we'd start off the new year by taking a more scientific footing and addressing some of the nutrition falsehoods that circulate wildly in cyberspace. And a lot of this article is based on the work of Joe Schwartz, director of the Office of Science and Society at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. He's the author of several best-selling books that attempt to set the record straight on a host of issues that commonly concern health-conscious people. Two of those books, Science, Sense, and Nonsense, published in 2009, and The Right Chemistry, published in 2012, address a lot of these myths. And the first one, Cured Meats. I don't know. I'm a huge fan of cured meats. I'll admit that. In fact, the only reason I take the seminar speaker to breakfast is so I can go out and have bacon with breakfast. And admittedly, I guess the cured meat thing illustrates the balance between dying of botulism and cholera versus living with, you know, issues that preserve foods. And curing, smoking, salting, that was something that's been around for a long, long time. And what they point out is that the reason you want to avoid cured meats is often you have compounds that will typically nitrates that will produce nitrosamines that have been associated with a lot of different bad health effects. But for those of you that don't eat these sorts of things, you risk bacterial contamination. And the more natural approach of preserving them in celery juice actually produces nitrites. So that's actually the means by with it which it works. The next one, meat glue. Which sounds a little dirty, but we're not going to go there. Probably something you're going to hear a lot more about. We've got an expert in molecular gastronomy coming on the show in a few weeks. And now chefs, famous chefs, are actually using a lot of these chemical tricks for different things. Meat glue is how you can make dishes sort of be coherent. It literally is that. They actually take transglutaminase and use it to glue stuff together. This is not a new thing. For example, we've done this sort of stuff in humans. Fibrin glue, where you actually take the fibrinogen from your own body and activate it so it will actually glue tissue together. I was concerned because it's actually used to make that artificial crab meat I make sushi with. And I do that a lot. And they point out that this is recognized as safe. Shouldn't be a problem, provided you cook the stuff. And since I put it in sushi, I'm going to reissue that stuff. But if you're actually cooking stuff with meat glue, you should be okay. They mentioned trans fats. And one of the things the article pointed out is there's a trans fat that is conjugated with linoleic acid. And linoleic acid actually is not a trans fat. It's got two cis groups in it, right? If you've got a molecule where it's all trans. It's sort of elongated. They crystallize really well. That's what makes your peanut butter a solid. That's why we hydrogenate these things to turn them into trans fat. And you eat a lot of trans fat. The problem is you need some that's not to avoid that. And apparently what they're making is they're gluing a non-trans fat onto these things and making it a little bit better. So that's what you want to look for. The whole question of organics, right? Everybody's worried about organic producers. And there is a question as to whether eliminating the herbicides and the pesticides will actually make the stuff more nutritious. Possibly not if it's ravaged by, you know, pests and other diseases. Farmed salmon was something that's been circulating a lot in cyberspace. Everybody's worried because they actually feed a commercial compound in the fish food to make them nice and pink, to give it that natural color. But salmon actually get that from algae anyway. So you're simply replacing this sorts of thing that you would see in natural algae. And my favorite one, the concluding one, nuts. So everyone says nuts are bad, they're fattening, things like that. But they do point out that nuts are these unsaturated heart-healthy fats, right? So if you have this little double bond across one of the hydrocarbon tails in this thing, and then you hydrogenate it, that will automatically go in this trans configuration, crystallize, makes things have nice consistency. But you need a little bit of those weird little kinked cis bonds in there to disrupt the packing of lipids in your cells. And that's what actually makes the members a little more flexible, right? So nuts good, unless you're allergic to them. And I'm going to leave it at that. So, okay, so let's begin talking about seismology. Do we want to start with the Italian thing?
We can.
Well, let's do that. So do you want to outline for us exactly what happened with regard to this group in Italy that in October 22nd were actually convicted, sentenced to a few years in prison over not properly warning the Italian people?
Sure. So back in 2009, there were a series of small tremors in an area of Italy near L'Aquila, which is an area that's known to be very seismically active. They often have tremors. After these tremors occurred, government officials asked this scientific body, which is supposed to advise them on earthquakes, whether or not they should be concerned about the tremors. And this group responded, no, they should not be concerned. This is very common, which it is. Subsequently, 3 months later, there was a major earthquake that killed over 300 people and significant damage. And because of that, they were convicted of not properly warning about the earthquake. And so many of us in the U.S. and around the world are up at arms because, as we all know, you can't predict an earthquake. Small tremors are not a precursor necessarily to a larger earthquake happening. And so it was really just shocking to everybody in the scientific and non-scientific community that scientists can be convicted of something like this.
But surely during the trial, there must have been testimony from folks like yourself, seismology people, who would say, as much as we put a lot of research into studying earthquakes and how they occur, and we have a much better understanding now than we did, say, 50, 60 years sure. ago about how earthquakes happen, to the point where we can, you know, assign statistical probability and we can look at patterns. But, you know, if a particular pattern of seismic activity occurs, I think about the best you can do is say, look, this means an earthquake might occur with a certain probability next week or in 90 years, yeah. right? I mean, that's my understanding from looking through the literature.
Yeah, that's true. And part of this is a subtle point. It's really risk communication. Mm-hmm. How do you communicate these very complex topics in terms of risk as it relates to earthquake risk? Perhaps the risk of having an earthquake may have gone up slightly because mm-hmm. of those tremors. So now it's instead of 1 in, say, 20,000,
yeah.
it may be 1 in 10,000.
Right.
In which
right.
case, it's still very rare and right. probably nothing's going to happen. But mm-hmm. I think how you communicate these risks is where scientists often get in trouble mm-hmm. because obviously you can't communicate it in a fashion that we're used to because nobody's going to know what to do with that information.
Right.
But if you communicate it in a very simple way, as they did, saying, no, everything should be fine,
right.
then this is what happens. So I think we as the scientific community need to really work harder to make sure we communicate things in a fashion that's understandable but yet gives a full picture in terms of what the risks
are. So then maybe it's an issue of scientific literacy that you're right. If someone said, look, the risk of a possible serious earthquake has doubled.
Right.
Then that's going to get somebody's attention.
Right.
But if you say it's changed from 1 in 20,000 to 1 in 10,000.
Exactly right.
As a scientist or an engineer, we deal with those probabilities all the time. And we simply realize that, you know, this is the luck of the draw. If you live near a coastal region and there's a giant, you know, seafloor depression like the tsunami that a few years ago hit Indonesia, it's going to be catastrophic.
Right.
So what's nice is then at least you get a little time for it to travel across the ocean.
That's right.
So warning systems will help you. But with earthquakes, sometimes even with volcanoes, depending on the, you know, if it's a pyroclastic flow, then you know, you've got a few minutes and you look out your window and you better hope your homeowner's insurance
right.
is paid
right.
up. So one of the interesting things and I wonder about the legal precedent of this, right? We're not lawyers, so we're not going to talk about those details. But in the closing arguments, the prosecutor of these seven scientists cited a United States court ruling that blamed the Army Corps of Engineers for monumental negligence for some of the flooding from Hurricane Katrina. And he sort of used that to obtain this conviction.
Yeah.
And to me, that seems as though you're comparing apples and oranges, right?
Because it's not a fair comparison at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So to me, that was more of an issue of management of a levee system and dams
sure.
and things like that. So these were artificial constructs.
Yep.
And I know I've actually worked with some folks over in EAS about volcanoes. There are volcanoes in Japan that literally have these big barriers to block pyroclastic flows and things like that. And of course, they're not going to eliminate them because pyroclastic flows can go thousands of feet into the air. But the bigger boulders tend to be on the bottom. So if you've got, you know, a 30-foot high fence, you'll get the ash and all this sort of thing raining down. But at least the giant boulders that might knock your house out would be mitigated to some degree. So
right.
you could tell, did that work or not? But the town may still have had
sure.
substantial damage, right?
Sure.
So to me, that's a man-made thing. Has anyone figured out why they got this conviction?
I think we're all still baffled. I think part of it is the Italian government. I think some people, I've heard some people say it was the way they wanted to find a scapegoat for this.
Okay.
People died and they
had
to find a scapegoat.
Governments do that sometimes,
and
not
some,
just the Italians.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And some people say it was a way that they, one of the respondents said it. They said it in a very flippant fashion. Oh, no, everything's fine. Go have a glass of wine and relax.
Uh-huh.
And so I think all that played into into what ended up happening, which, again, I think many of us think is just insane.
Right. But to be honest, though, they are Italian. And having traveled in Italy and worked with scientists in Italy, Italians, a little more laid back.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
To me, an American might have given perhaps a little more alert-based response, but not much, because as you said, it probably was not justified. These things sort of happen all the time. We look at, say, Mount St. Helens, for example. You know, nobody saw that thing coming.
Right.
And even though there was seismic activity going up to the
right.
front of that.
Right.
So you actually know one of the scientists that was convicted.
I know him very well. I spent a summer. He actually started an engineering school, an earthquake engineering school in Italy called mm-hmm. the Rolls School. He's a very well-known scientist. He's actually an engineer, mm-hmm. Structural engineer, and he was on this panel. And I spent two summers ago, I spent a month out there teaching a class at this school, which is all an international mm-hmm. Body of professors. And he was going through this process. This was after the L'Aquila earthquake, so he was going through the process. And he really didn't think it was going to end up the way it did,
right.
although he ended up spending millions of dollars of his own money uh-huh. Trying to fight it.
To defend this.
To defend himself, absolutely. And it's amazing what's happened. And he sent me an email about a week after the trial and just said, you know, he's very disappointed. He likely will not stay in Italy, and he's just reaching out to his friends to let them know that
right.
if there are other opportunities, he's going to pursue them.
Right. So what I'm hearing by even one of the convicted scientists is everybody's shocked.
Yeah.
Nobody really knows the logic behind this thing. And I think you may have the best guess, I think, which is the Italian government, we saw damage, people were outraged, they wanted a scapegoat.
Yep.
And that's often true, you know, for a presidential assassination or things like that. You know, everybody wants a scapegoat. But really? Scientists? So then here's the question is, what will the fallout from this thing be? I mean, basically all the articles I read have said now scientists, particularly seismologists in
yeah.
Italy, won't talk to anyone about anything or do what we do now, right? So as a chemical engineer, I talk to students about material safety data sheets all the time. And most material safety data sheets are not all that useful. They tend to overwarn people to cover the legal side of things.
Right.
And what happens is if it's a simple sort of thing, they tend to overwarn. And if it's a very dangerous chemical, they tend to hide the danger somewhere in there as long as it's reported properly so that whether it's water or something that bursts into flames, all
right.
material safety data sheets all read about the same. You know, if you spill water, you're supposed to put on rubber boots and a mask and things like that. So my question is, will we eventually have a good Samaritan law for scientists and engineers?
I don't know. I think from my perspective and talking to a lot of my colleagues, I think we're going to be very careful about what we say,
mm-hmm.
particularly to the popular media when they ask us about, you know, is it safe
right.
to do X?
Right.
I think we'll be much more cautious and probably we'll just give the scientific information saying, well, this area has small risk. It still has a risk
right.
nonetheless, as opposed to advising them on what they should do. We'll just give them the technical information and let them decide how they want to use it.
Right. But, I mean, is the public in general familiar with this sort of thing? So, for example, this risk assessment is everywhere.
Sure.
If you go ahead and look at any maps, right, there's the 100-year floodplain and the 50-year floodplain and the 20-year floodplain. And the point is, people, well, 50-year floodplain, and then they live in their house for, you know, 43 years, and they realize that's a stochastic, that's a statistical
right.
characterization, could happen next week.
Sure.
Now, it's not going to happen every 2 years. But once in your lifetime, if you're in a 50-year floodplain, there's a reasonable chance that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And somebody moves in their house, 10 weeks later it floods, they're shocked that it happened.
Yeah.
And
it's even worse for earthquakes because it's much more of a rare event. We designed for a 2,500-year earthquake, believe it or not.
Okay.
That's the event we designed for, which is, you know, you're talking about a typical
right.
lifetime in 2,500 years.
Right.
And so the chances are it will not happen to your home.
Okay.
And so I think deciding what to do about that is, in my opinion, one of the biggest challenges in the field. It's not the technical challenges of how you design columns and beams. It's really, given this rare event,
right.
but given the catastrophic consequences, mm-hmm. how you determine what level of safety is
right.
safe enough.
Right. And the problem with that is an extremely complicated thing.
Absolutely.
Because we don't have infinite resources.
Right.
Right. I mean,
that's exactly
you
right.
could sit down and say, in this particular area, 2,500-year earthquake is 8.5 on the Richter scale. And you guys have all sorts of models about structures, and you can say, how much can it take? And, you know, what soil is on? Is it on, you know, bedrock? Is it on landfill? Like
right.
a lot of the issues in the San Francisco earthquake a number of years ago. And you can design that. But then you say, well, here it is for the 25-foot earthquake. Right. And someone says, I have half that much money to spend. And then there's politics and, you know, government and things like that. How difficult is it to deal with that section, that part of it?
It's very complex. It's actually, believe it or not, easier in California, where they do have frequent earthquakes.
Right.
And you see 89 and 94. Yeah. And they
and
know
they have a more systematic approach.
They
to
do.
It.
They right. do. And they know that they will have an earthquake. I think it's 80% chance of a 7.5 or greater in San Francisco in the next 20 years. So they will have an earthquake there because it's a very seismically active area. So it makes sense to go through and retrofit all their bridges, which they have been doing since 1971 following the earthquake there. Whereas on the East Coast, where we have very large earthquakes, but they're very, very rare.
Yeah.
It's much more complex.
Yeah.
Clearly, politics plays into it. And I've talked to some bridge engineers out here. I've done some research for various states. I won't name them. But they've told me, I can't do anything about it. I just hope it doesn't happen on my watch. It's just such a rare event. And that's all they care to do.
Okay. All right. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, what I'd like to talk about is that issue and how you share that with students at Georgia Tech. Especially given that Eric, who's one of the board today, is one of your students. And let's even tackle that before we even think about the public, right? So if you can't explain it to a student who studies this stuff, it's even more difficult to explain that to a public, to the public. But if you are listening live Wednesdays, noon to 1, and you do have a question or comment about earthquakes and earthquake prediction, preparedness, and these sorts of things for Reggie, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Genius. Power.
Have you ever wondered about your neighbors? Maybe wondered about the weird thumps and bumps or chants emanating from their apartment? Well, they may be followers of Bob.
Well, here's a deal you might not want to miss. Salvation or triple your money back.
Bob Dogs came to town to set you free!
Reverend Ivan Stang says he'll offer an immense cash prize to anyone who can prove that Bob Dobbs is just a piece of clip art.
Now, at last, the step-by-step process is revealed. This is it, the only faith that promises action, thrills, success in sex and business.
Bob is great.
The Sub-Genius Hour of Slack. Saturdays at midnight. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Repent! Quit your job! Slack off! And
that was fantastic.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. The average American uses 650 pounds of paper each year. 100 million tons of wood could be saved each year if all that paper was recycled. You can help keep our forest green. Visit keepatlantabeautiful.org to find out more information and to find a recycling center near you.
In the year 521, Boethius introduces the Greek musical letter notation to the West. In the year 800, poems are sung to music at Charlemagne's court. In 1717, Handel's Water Music is first performed on the Thames. In 1783, Beethoven's first works are printed. In 1895, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake is performed for the first time in St. Petersburg. In the mid-1970s, historians identified this period as the beginning of contemporary classical music. Today, you can experience classics firsthand from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. weekdays here at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about earthquake seismology, the recent conviction of the Italian scientists for... I guess what the Italian courts would say being negligent, really, is what they're saying. And for engineers, that's a real serious charge that most of the scientific community thinks is unwarranted in that case. But during the break, we actually got a question about the relationship between tectonic shift and the molten core of the Earth. So what is that relationship?
Yeah, so essentially you have these number of very large blocks, roughly 15, which are sitting on this molten rock, and it's a very dynamic process. So these plates are continually shifting They actually move relative to each other at around the same rate as your fingernails grow, several centimeters per year. As they're shifting and they get locked in place, you build up stress. And I'm sure most of the students out there know as stress increases, at some point you exceed the strength of the rock and the rock fractures, and that's what an earthquake happens. And so because of that dynamic process, earthquakes will continue to happen. There is some predictability in the sense of the recurrence of earthquakes because the process is predictable in the sense that it locks up, it builds up stress, it breaks, and then it locks up again for a number of years, builds up stress and breaks. And so it's something that continues to happen, and we can follow the recurrence of it, particularly in areas that have very well-defined tectonic structures.
So that's a really good analogy about as fast as your fingernails grow. I like that. That's something people can relate to, even me, who knows nothing about this field.
But that's still incredibly, incredibly slow. Just saying.
Thinking
about how slow that moves.
But if you think about it, so you're right. California is not going to be up by Alaska anytime soon. But having lived in both Northern and Southern California, I go hiking a lot. And you will actually see geological markers all over the place.
Absolutely.
And my understanding is... How often do they recalibrate those in a state like California?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah, so
all
they're doing it more than once a year?
Yeah.
So over a year or so, things move, change, and shift.
So the best example, if you're ever in California, although you can't see it anymore because they just finished retrofitting it, the Memorial Stadium where the California football team plays is actually right above the Haywood Fault, which runs right north of the campus.
Right.
And there are two sections. I remember when I was at school there are two sections that are separated by several feet from each other. And you can actually see one seat come in, the bar twisting and then going in the other area it's been moving since the Haywood Fault last ruptured several tens of years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear, particularly in California.
To go back really quick to the fingernail analogy, I feel like it's one of those things where it moves, but you never really notice it until you look at it again.
Right.
So you're
a year or 10 years
later.
Yeah,
and you look back, and all of a sudden it's over here.
Right. So that's exactly what it's like.
Very interesting.
Right. So, it seems to me over long periods of time, you could look at the San Andreas Fault and other faults out there in California, or hot spots around these edges of the tectonic plates, and look at the pattern, and then predict the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd predict the pattern in terms of relative probabilities over years, decades, centuries, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. They look at it and they say, boy, this has been moving for 50 years. It's built up roughly this amount of stress. We know the maximum stress it can take before it breaks. It's ready to go any day now or any year now. And they'll say typically that this has a 50% chance in the next 20 years.
Right.
They're not at the point where they can say this is going to happen tomorrow at 5 p.m.
Right.
We're very far
from
that, obviously.
Right. Right. So to be able to predict things on the orders of weeks, months, or even within a particular year is beyond the realm of this science.
That's correct.
Period.
That's correct.
Yet the Italians seem to think it wasn't beyond the realm of that science. I mean, so maybe I'll blame us again. Is this our fault that we don't educate people about this very fact we just mentioned, that they don't understand this is the limit of predictability?
Yeah.
So what about a different approach? Do the civil engineers, the structural engineers, the mechanical engineers ever get together and say, look, if you're living on top of this fault, there is a certain amount of risk that you have explicitly agreed to take on by doing that. Deal with it and don't blame us for it.
Well, I mean, I think in California in particular, where you have defined fault lines, people cannot live within a certain distance of a fault. So that you just can't do it in California. They have they have laws against that. In other areas, I think we do try to educate them and say, you are in a seismic zone 4 and you have X probability of having a large earthquake in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
One, you might want to get earthquake insurance
because
if you don't, you have the likelihood of getting significant damage.
Right.
And two, you might want to take responsibility and be prepared for that earthquake, meaning do certain things to your home, have kits prepared, et cetera.
Right.
So I think, again, in places that have frequent earthquakes, California, Japan, New Zealand, parts of Chile, they do that, and I think they do that fairly well. It's in those places that haven't had an earthquake in our lifetime you know, they never heard of such a thing.
For example, in Charleston.
In Charleston, for example. Last time they had an earthquake was 1886.
Right.
It was a big one. It was the biggest on the East Coast in the history of since we've been recording earthquakes. And so some people in Charleston, to their credit, they do retrofit their homes. And you see, if you go through, you see these steel rods that go through historic buildings to try to keep them together when the earth shakes. Right. But not all structures are retrofitted, and not only homes, but bridges and other things. Not all of them have been retrofitted the way they should be, given the high hazard there.
Right, right. Whereas most of the buildings in hotspots like Japan and California are certainly that way. So speaking of that, speaking of modern earthquake building techniques, right, and over the past several decades, we've learned a lot about this stuff, right? I mean, so over in the civil engineering department, you guys have tables and you're shaking stuff and do all sorts of research. And people think, well, what's the whole point? But actually, they've learned a lot about the way to do structures. And that brings me to a question. The earthquake over in Italy was a 6.3 on the Richter scale, yet it basically demolished the entire historic downtown area of this particular city. And when I think of 6.3, I barely wake up for a 4.0 in California when I live for it. And usually I wasn't right on top of the epicenter. But 6.3s, well, that's going to cause some damage. But was the damage so bad over in Italy because these were the old brick and mortar, marble, brittle, no rebar, twisted inside of reinforced concrete kind of thing?
My guess would be most likely.
Yeah, I think it's there are a number of factors. That, just saying the number 6.3 doesn't tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. It's a function of how deep the earthquake was and the soil properties. Some soil properties can amplify by a factor of two or three or more.
Plus just the difference between a 4 and a 6.3 is orders of magnitude. Right.
So each time you go up by one, it's about 32. So
it's a log scale.
Yeah, it's a log scale.
So and all you have to do is say that to a scientist or engineer. Yeah. So what is the base? Is it a base 10 log?
Yeah, it's a log. It's a 10 to the 1.5. So it's a factor of 32.
Yeah.
So the difference between the Italy earthquake and the Chile earthquake was over 1,000, maybe 1,500. So
right, exactly.
6.3 to 8.8. So huge differences in energy that's released. Yes, you were right. Going back to your first statement, this is the types of structures, the unreinforced masonry, URM structures, are the most dangerous in the world. And there are still a few of those in California. They're really trying to work hard to address all of those, but there are tons of them in Charleston, tons of them in St. Louis, tons of them in D.C. And in fact, some of them were damaged in the earthquake in D.C. a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And so that is the most dangerous structures, unreinforced masonry, where you have very little steel.
And that is, unreinforced masonry is exactly what people like to build. Opera houses, cathedrals, all these nice artsy buildings, Capitol buildings.
Absolutely.
Although our Capitol building, the dome, I once read was iron.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
That's how they built it so quickly. They actually clamped together pieces of iron. Mm. But I'm wondering about the National Cathedral, which sustained some serious damage.
It did. Those were all unreinforced masonry.
Can we change that now? Can we do rebar and reinforced concrete and then put nice tiles on the outside to make an artistic-looking building that will hold up in an earthquake?
With the existing buildings or with something new?
Okay, let's make it easy for ourselves. You're building from scratch.
Sure, absolutely. You just put steel inside.
Okay.
But retrofitting is the challenge.
Yes.
And particularly retrofitting historical structures is a challenge because you can't change the visual look of them. So, you might want to go in and put these big X braces around it, but then historically you can't do that for a number of reasons. So what they do, there's a technology called base isolation. I'm not sure if any of you have heard of this, but it's essentially putting the entire structure on these floating pieces of rubber so that when the earthquake comes, the entire building moves as a rigid body and all the deformation is in these rubber pads that are pretty much several hundred of them at the base of the structure.
Right. So basically giant dampeners that just absorb
They're isolated. So you can imagine you go in and cut every single column in the building, lift up the building, it's what they do. They go in and put these things, these rubber things that are about a meter in diameter and about half a meter tall, very flexible laterally. When the earthquake comes, it just moves like a rigid body and there's no deformation or damage in the structure.
Now, what does that kind of thing cost?
That sounds like quite a job,
If you're retrofitting, it costs quite a bit, obviously. Yeah. If you're building new, which they do for some critical structures, it's about 2 to 5% of your structure. But it goes back to your initial question. Yeah. Is 2 to 5% worth it for something that happens roughly every 2,500 years?
But 2 to 5%, you can have a conversation about that.
Yeah.
But to go in, and I just think about these things, and some of these buildings, they're already so old and brittle that just the act of cutting and putting things under the columns, you'll damage the masonry, you'll have to fix it. And then there's always some curator there who, okay, you damaged a piece of tile, but the tile, Da Vinci painted or something, they get all upset about
especially like a floor tile or just something simple.
Yeah, something simple like that.
Yeah. That's only your only option for historical structures in the U.S. and in many cities is to actually isolate them, because otherwise putting in bracing systems would violate some rules they have about changing too much these structures.
Right. So so back to what we had planned and talked about. How do you convince someone where it occurs rarely, like the East Coast, right? Yeah. I mean, the Appalachian and the Blue Ridge Mountains didn't come from nowhere,
right?
There was activity there at some point, and there probably will be again. It's not a hot spot, you know, like Japan and the Western United States. How do you convince them to think about these sorts of things?
It's a challenge. It's, I mean, from my opinion, it's probably the biggest challenge people in the field face is convincing building owners or owners of infrastructure like bridges that they need to do something. And the approach I've been taking is to show them that it doesn't cost much. We can do analysis to show that really small levels of investment can have a huge payback. And so we have all sorts of sophisticated analysis that we can conduct cost-benefit analysis to show for, you know, small costs you can get a huge payout over the next 100 years should an event occur. But it's still a huge challenge.
Right.
And we're helped, oddly enough, when you have these cases like Sandy or earthquake in D.C., it inspires the states around them to say, okay, well, maybe we should start looking at it happened in 2003, in fact, when we had the earthquake here. I don't know if you were here at the time. We had a small earthquake in Fort Payne, Alabama. It was 4.5, I think. I shook up a few things in northern Georgia, and I got a call from the bridge engineer who said, I think we should look at some of our bridges and make sure that they're okay. And we had a study, and we recommended some things. And again, it often takes something happening for people to wake up and say, well, maybe we should look at how we do things.
Yeah, I will admit I'm not very good. So I lived in both Northern California right after the big one there. Well, we had aftershocks for years, and I've also lived in Southern California. So, you know, unless things are falling over on my desk, I won't even get up and go to the doorway anymore. And so I remember that little thing. I didn't feel anything. And people laugh at people in California saying, well, how can they be that way? But it's what you're used to, right? Sure. In the Midwest, you're used to tornadoes. You're like, well, there's a tornado coming. Let's move the TV to the basement or whatever.
And watch TV in the basement.
Yeah,
right.
That's basically what you do.
By the way, going in a doorway is not the right thing to do.
What is the right thing to do?
The general accepted rule is what we call duck, cover, and hold, where you duck underneath something that's sturdy, a table, for example.
Okay.
Cover your head with the table or something else, and then hold onto that because that will likely be whipping around the room.
Right, right.
And so the majority of injuries occur in the U.S. and developed countries in reasonably safe buildings from glass breaking or items falling off of walls. And so you want to make sure you're covered so that you don't get injured like that. In the U.S., we're fortunate that buildings don't typically just collapse like they did in Haiti.
Right.
And so you just want to make sure you protect yourself from falling debris, because that's where people get injured and some cases killed.
All right, so that's actually very insightful. So what you're saying is, you know, I'm out. So when I was working at IBM or something like that, and I'll never forget, whenever we got an aftershock, all the guys in that hall we'd be in the doorways looking at each other, saying hello. What you're saying is, the danger is not the collapse of the building.
Typically,
The danger is things falling off walls, things, you know, walls falling, glass breaking. So get covered. And if the building collapses, it's irrelevant where you're standing anyway.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
You're going down in a pile of rubble.
That's exactly right.
Although being under a table might actually help a little bit.
If
you're lucky.
Yeah.
Right?
If it's a good table.
And then hopefully you can, you know, be there for less than 3 days, not die of dehydration or have to eat your own leg. ironically, I was living in Switzerland at the time, and I was up all night working on something that I was late for getting done, and I was listening to the news. And my German is not that good, but I did recognize exactly what they were talking about when the news came on at 3 a.m. and there was this earthquake in California. And lo and behold, it was on CNN and even the international channels when I got over there. And they're showing this collapsed double-decker highway, the bottom part of which I had drove on literally 2 months before when I was out in Northern California visiting some guys at IBM and Berkeley, actually. And It's the luck of the draw, right?
Yeah, it is.
And 2 months is the blink of an eye in seismic time.
It is. Yeah. I was a student at the time of that earthquake at Berkeley, a mechanical engineering student.
Right.
And actually, that kind of motivated me to change my major to civil engineering. And I was on campus, and I could see the smoke coming from the Bay Bridge, as well as the Cypress structure that collapsed.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that was nearly 25 years ago now.
So it's funny. I was just out there a little while ago with my daughter. We were driving across the Bay Bridge, and I was showing her the exact portion where the thing fell over.
Okay, good.
And yeah, she doesn't live out there. She can't relate to it at all.
Sure.
Well, so what you're saying is a natural disaster actually motivated you to change the direction of your research.
It did. I thought I was fascinated by it. I grew up in New York. It was my first big earthquake.
Wow.
I was really fascinated by all these structures around me moving. And I obviously, as a mechanical engineer, I'd taken dynamics classes and enjoyed that aspect of engineering.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, I'm going to do structural engineering and study earthquakes.
Okay. All right, well, let's do this. Let's take another quick break, and when we come back, let's talk about how one actually deals with the fact that earthquakes can come. How do we sort of retrofit this sort of thing, other than taking historic buildings and putting them on rubber feet, but how design principles perhaps have changed. And again, if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, and you've got a question about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness and structures, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier. Cool.
You like that? If you want to listen to more smooth African tunes like this one, tune in to Sub-Saharan Vibes from 9 to 10 p.m. every Monday on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. Too much exposure to sunlight may increase your risk for vision damage. The American Academy of Ophthalmology reminds you to be eye smart in the sun and wear sunglasses with a UV 400 or 100% UV protection label. Visit geteyesmart.org for more tips on protecting your eyes.
For a little bit of everything from all over the globe, tune in to Weekend Cornucopia every Saturday and Sunday here on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Reggie DeRoche, the chair of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at Georgia Tech, about earthquakes, earthquake prediction, preparedness, and how to deal with that whole phenomenon. So if you're building a building from scratch, right, so we're not dealing with these historic buildings in Italy that may have suffered more damage than they would have had they been built by modern code standards. How do we do things differently now than we did 50 years ago with regard to making buildings?
Sure. We've learned a lot, and we unfortunately have to learn. We learn the most after an earthquake occurs, and we go out and do what we call reconnaissance and study what failed and what didn't fail.
Well, let me be honest with you. Every field of science and engineering learns it that way. Right? We wish we didn't.
That's true.
Yeah.
The difference is, unlike some fields, like mechanicals, if you're building a car, we can't build a test car and crash it in a wall and see, because we have to, because these structures are huge, although we can do components. The key is all in the details. It's all about building in what we call ductility. In a section. So if we take concrete structures, for example, because the majority of buildings are made of some sort of reinforced concrete, we want to make sure that the connections are ductile. How do you make them ductile? It's by putting adequate amount of steel in the right places. It's really not rocket science. We know how we have to tie the steel together to ensure that these joints can bend quite a bit and not break. We don't design structures to be elastic. We actually design them to yield. But we design them to yield in a fashion that we can control it yielding and allow it to flex back and forth so that after the earthquake, there's some level of damage, but people can get out safely. And that's the design philosophy that we use.
And also find a spot where you can see it yielding, but doesn't necessarily collapse.
That's
correct. So you can kind of notice it and be, okay, now we should evacuate.
That's correct. And so that's traditional codes have been all about life safety.
Mm-hmm.
We'll allow damage in your structure. We'll allow you to have to actually tear it down and rebuild, but it won't collapse on you. And that's been kind of the traditional codes. And we've realized in the U.S. in particular that while that's fine, the economic cost of that is just too staggering. So they're, hundreds of billions of dollars in the Northridge earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And so the new generation of codes is what we call performance-based, where now we're saying we can do better than just get out of the building and your life is safe. Let's build it so there's no damage or minimal damage or repairable right. damage so that right. we don't have these huge economic costs. Right.
So like surface damage. It's easy to go in and swap out drywall,
right.
but if you have to change the load-bearing members, then you're starting to approach tearing down big chunks of the building.
Yeah, absolutely. So the wow. Northridge earthquake in 94 in California was a perfect example. There were tons of buildings that looked fine. They may have been leaning a little bit, but when you pull back the cladding, and steel buildings, in fact, these joints had failed.
Okay.
And they cost, I think, what numbers I heard were $20,000 per connection mm-hmm. to repair. So, you know, over an entire, you know, multi-story building, you're talking tens of millions of dollars in some cases to repair a building. So the community came together and said, we got to do better than that. We got to have a more performance-based code that allows the designer and the owner of the building to say, for my plant, I want continued operation. I don't want any damage. I don't want people to have to leave for months mm-hmm. because this plant is so critical. This building mm-hmm. is so critical. Mm-hmm.
So when did that change occur?
It's changed over the last 10 years or so.
Okay.
Really,
so relatively recent.
Fairly recent. I think the Northridge earthquake in particular motivated this this change of thought that we really need to be more performance-based mm-hmm. and allow the owner to say, if I have a critical plant, for example, if I have an Intel mm-hmm. plant in Northern California that's producing these chips, I can't afford to be out of operation for yeah. a single hour, much less several weeks.
Right.
And so I want to be able to have the engineer design that structure to a standard where even at a large earthquake, it's going to be operational.
Right.
And past codes didn't allow for that.
Because it probably costs a fortune for those plants even to shut down for
Absolutely.
A few days.
Absolutely.
And if you have to repair or replace the entire structure, that's...
It's money lost.
Tons of money, yeah.
The cost of actually just doing the retrofit is probably less than a day's right. worth of not being in operation.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I think the average person doesn't understand. There are plants that produce millions and millions of dollars of income per day. So if you're talking millions, even tens of millions, or hundreds of millions, if you're out for a year or so, it can be offset by the income
Absolutely.
From that particular
Absolutely.
Thing. That's actually – so I did not know that. And I think our audience learned some important things about, you know, elastic versus ductile, right? So elastic is basically saying it deforms and it snaps right back to where it is, like a rubber band.
Right.
Whereas ductile undergoes a permanent sort of plastic deformation, right? And I work in polymers, so one of the things we taught about polymers is that they undergo plastic deformation, unlike this, you know, brittle masonry you're talking about,
right.
such that, okay, they will deform. The seal will fail, but the seal won't fail catastrophically.
Right. That's
It'll
right.
still stay
That's
there.
Right.
So
That's
the girders
right.
will bend, things will get messed up, but it will still stand, and the table that both you guys are encouraging me to be under, you know, we'll keep the bookshelf off my head and we should
right.
be okay. So how do you now make it such that it'll absorb all the same amount of energy but then be usable again without these failures of these big steel joints?
Yeah, and there are ways, and we have different approaches. You know, one of the things that we know we need to do, if you want it to be completely operational, we recommend that you put it on base isolators.
Okay.
I mean, if you want no damage, because if you do that, your structure will likely not be damaged at all. In fact, all the structures that were isolated in Chile and Japan during their recent large earthquakes were completely operational, no damage at all.
Okay. Pretty much to simplify that really quick, it's if your building is off the ground and not really connected to the ground except on these big rubber things, then it's not going to have any damage.
It's not going to have any damage.
Okay. And 2-5%, as you mentioned before, is a small cost to ensure that. Even if it were 10%, that would still be relatively small.
Right. But construction overhead is very, you know, the margins are very small in construction, and so to a contractor, 2-5% may be a lot. But to a building owner, depending on what the building is used for, it may not be a lot. It's all in the details and how you wrap the steel around and how you detail your connection to make sure that you have very, very minimal damage. And we know how to do that very well.
Okay. So how does the civil and mechanical engineering community communicate this to contractors?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the challenge. And there's no part of the challenge is that there's no benefit. Let's use the East Coast, for example. There's no benefit to having a more ductile structure.
Right.
You can't charge more rent to say, oh, this building is it's good for a 2,500-year earthquake, so I'm going to charge you more rent than the building next door.
Right.
Especially in a place like here.
Yeah, especially like Memphis or St. Louis
or
here.
Right.
I mean, people will laugh at you and say, well, it's not going to be an earthquake.
But if you've got a data server and you're Google and you can't have that go down, could convince Google to pay an extra 10%
Absolutely.
For that building.
And for example, FedEx. I use FedEx because they're in an area. St. Louis is an area that's very close to what we call the New Madrid seismic zone. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
Oh.
It's in New Madrid, Missouri, southern Missouri, southern Illinois, excuse me, northeastern Missouri, southern Illinois. That area where all those states come together has the largest earthquake we've ever had in the continental U.S. outside of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
In 1811, 1812, there were a series of earthquakes that we believe were on the order of 8.2.
Wow.
And so we know there are huge earthquakes there. And because of the way the soil structure is on the East Coast, that earthquake was felt as far west as Denver and as far east as Philadelphia. The Mississippi River ran backwards for a while. So it was just a huge earthquake.
Wow.
It ran backwards. That's pretty incredible.
It flowed backwards. So the cities that are closest to that are St. Louis and Memphis. And so there's a lot of controversy over how they should design structures there because they are in an area that has large but very infrequent earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a region where it's very dangerous. So telling an owner what to do there is complex because it's such a rare event.
Okay, and has FedEx at least entertained
yes.
this?
Yes, so FedEx, yeah. FedEx is they've made sure they have systems in place. They have, in some cases, I think they have an isolated building, but they know that that there's a chance that if an earthquake happens and their data systems are down, mm-hmm. they'll be in big trouble, internationally. So they've taken a number of precautions to try to ensure that they have minimal damage in their systems.
Wow. So basically what you're saying, it's easy to communicate this cost benefits trade-off to large corporations that have 24/7 critical mission type operations in areas where there are regularly occurring earthquakes or there may be.
Yeah.
Whereas someone in the East Coast or somewhere else in the continental United States that's, you know, never heard of earthquakes happening.
Well,
and that's interesting. I didn't know we had an 1811 earthquake.
1811, 1812, New Madrid earthquake.
Where the Mississippi River ran backwards.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was a huge earthquake.
Yeah. Why isn't this in history books? Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, people don't know about it. All my students know about it because that's the first thing I talk about in class. And we would be impacted here. In fact, all the historical data showed that many of the structures in Atlanta had what we call non-structural damage, bricks falling off, chimneys falling off, windows breaking.
Mm-hmm.
But it would certainly impact us today when that earthquake repeats.
So then this really brings us to an issue that we brought up previously when we were talking in the break about communication.
Yeah.
So if I'm this utterly ignorant, and trust me, I'm ignorant on a regular basis about a lot of things, about, you know, this Midwestern potential for earthquakes. I've got a lot of family that live in the Midwest. I was in St. Louis a few weeks ago. I mean, do earthquake people, civil engineers, structural engineers, what can we do to be communicating with the public better?
Yeah, and to some extent they know. Next time you're in St. Louis, drive around, look at the bridges. You'll see sometimes they're wrapped with wires or they have what we call a concrete case around the columns.
Okay.
Those are all retrofit approaches that they've done, or they'll connect the deck with a cable to the column to make sure that it doesn't unseat and completely catastrophically fall off. So they've gone through, at least the bridge owners have gone through and done something. I think it's more the homeowners that haven't been through this.
So
just haven't been through this at all.
Businesses and bridges are protecting themselves, but not really telling anybody else.
I think they tell people. I mean, people. I guarantee you, everybody in St. Louis and Memphis probably knows of the New Madrid seismic zone. They may not think it's going to happen. They probably think it won't happen to them. And in fact, seismologists argue over what the recurrence interval is. So is it 200 years, which means they're due now, or many say it's 2,000 years, which means, God, they have 1,800 years or so.
And even though that sounds like you people know nothing about what you're doing, the difference between 200 and 2,000 years, that is the error bar.
Absolutely.
On this stuff. I mean, I love the geologists that point to the reversal of the magnetic moment in the transatlantic ridge. And you can actually look at that magnetic orientation. It basically says every so many hundred million years, we reverse the polarity of the Earth. We're due.
Mm-hmm.
Could be 2 years, could be 2,000.
Could
we
be
don't
tomorrow.
Really know.
Right.
They say there's going to be a transition, right, where we'll have this instability for a while. Could last a year, could last 1,000 years, where we'll have multipoles all over the place. You'll see the Aurora Borealis in different places. But that's the error bar on it. It could happen next week or it can happen in 2,000 years. So people don't think about it. But yeah, I know when I grew up in California, in Southern California, I was in elementary school then. You had the fire safety unit. You had the earthquake preparedness unit. Everyone at least knew to bolt bookcases, and you had water. Everyone knew that in Northern and Southern California. Whereas I'm wondering how many people in St. Louis really. Yeah.
Or Charleston again.
Or yeah. Charleston. I think Charleston's probably worse off than St. Louis.
Yeah. That earthquake again happened in 1886 and was a 7.3.
Yep.
That's
a big earthquake.
And rather large for a coastal town.
If it happens again, people will die, and there'll be quite a few economic losses will be staggering.
Right. So so what's the future of earthquake preparedness and all this stuff?
You know, I think we're learning more. We're learning more about how we make these structures safer. While we can't predict earthquakes, there are a number of what they call early warning systems on the market.
Right.
And the way these things work is that we know there are micro tremors 30 to 60 seconds before the big tremor comes.
Okay.
And so in Japan, for example, many of the buildings have these warning alarms that come on when there's a micro tremor telling people get out of the building because there might be a big earthquake.
Right.
The problem with those is that there's so many false alarms.
Right.
Many false alarms to the point where people don't always listen to them because chances are it's another false alarm.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I'm working. So they haven't perfected that yet. As that gets better, I think at least we'll be able to get people in safe areas during an earthquake seconds before.
So it sounds gratuitous, but the answer is continued research.
Yes, continued research.
Right. And every time we say that, people, you're just looking for you people are getting rich off these earthquakes.
We need more funding. More funding for earthquake research.
Which is, if you actually look at the funding from NSF, NIH, and what we get even out of companies now, it is a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on
a lot of things. Not even a drop.
Yeah, absolutely. The round off dust of the DOD budget.
That's exactly
what,
right.
Trent, our regular engineer, does a lot of work for them. So we've come to the end of the show, the portion of the show that we like to call "What Have We Learned?" Well, I've learned a whole bunch. First of all, that the seven convicted scientists back in October of this year in Italy, maybe they're scapegoats because there didn't seem to be a reasonable set of evidence to actually convict them of something that's so difficult to predict in the beginning. All the articles I read say they're going to appeal.
They're appealing. He said the appeal is going to take place for the next 5 years.
Okay.
So nobody's going to jail immediately, but they're spending their money, that's for sure.
Okay. But it actually has tremendous ramifications for whether or not do scientists and engineers now need a Good Samaritan law with regard to doing your best due diligence at warning people about what you think is really there. And it really is just your best guess.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And if you make your best guess and other external scientists, which is always the peer-reviewed reference we've always used, say, look, you know, that was not an unreasonable thing to say. Right. I don't think it would be unreasonable in the United States. Definitely not in Italy.
Right.
Where they enjoy kicking back with wine and not worrying about the impending doom of the earthquake. The 6.3 earthquake over there in Italy that did so much damage, in part, right, and you did remind us that it's not just the total energy released in the earthquake. It's where it happens, how deep it happens, what is the nature of the soil in between it, right? So in the California earthquake, the loose packed landfill liquefied. Right, actually behaved like a liquid, so liquefaction, very different than bedrock or other sorts of things. But part of that was due to the fact that these historic buildings, big, big challenge, right? They're brittle masonry, they're going to fall apart.
Yep.
Retrofitting is really expensive. Probably one of the best ways that you can actually deal with this is to put it on rubber isolators, right? To literally put it on these sorts of things that when it shakes, the ground shakes, but the building doesn't.
Yep.
That may be the best way to do it for even modern buildings. If you have companies that are in California or maybe near this St. Louis fault that you mentioned, have mission-critical things, data servers, factories, you know, a company like FedEx that needs to operate 24/7, that may be the best way to actually do it. Because retrofitting is really, really expensive. So do it right from the beginning. And then you also at least admonish me for running to the doorway all those years I lived in California. The biggest danger here in the United States is things falling, glass breaking, building collapse. And it's funny, when you see these things happening in Turkey and Italy, old buildings do collapse.
Right.
That's rare in the United States.
That's right.
So getting under the table rather than getting in the door. And if the building collapsed, well, good luck to you. Anyway.
Just stay under the table. You'll be fine.
Yeah. And then there's been maybe a shift in the last 10 years from building ductility, getting things to bend and permanently deform in a way that preserves the building to preserve life. That was always the standard. And, of course, that standard is much better known and much more systematic in places where things occur on a regular basis, like California, right? So California, for example, they have for the professional engineers exam, they have their own earthquake section to the structural engineering certification. Right. Do other states have that?
Well, other states have it now. Georgia has that.
Earthquake section
in Georgia. Okay. And a special structural exam.
Okay.
There's an earthquake part in there.
Okay. But 20 years ago, that was not the case. No. Okay. And then, but you're pointing out that we're actually changing the standard over maybe the last decade or so to actually have buildings remain with minimal repair and damage so they can keep operating.
Right.
So it's not just a saving life thing. And if I were to think of one basic theme, the basic theme is rare events are the enemy of scientists and engineers, right? It's not only, and we've always known it's our enemy because it makes it difficult to study, difficult to characterize. But what it really does is it makes it very difficult to communicate the appropriate risk assessment to normal people who aren't used to the 2,500-year earthquake, the 100-year floodplain,
right.
that's a statistical characterization, and it could still happen at any moment, and you could have two right back to back, but right. on average, over thousands of years, it's the 2,500-year thing. Wow. So that's tough.
Yeah, it is tough.
That's
how to mitigate against these things are huge.
Yeah. And I will say this. This is why civil engineers have the utmost respect for me, right? So most of the faculty over in chemical engineering, very few of us are actually PEs because you need PEs to certify plans and certain things. You work for governments, things like that. Chemical engineers, we work for all private guys, right. most of the guys that do research. It's not that important unless you work for a consulting firm. Civil engineering, everyone has to be a PE because of the nature of dealing with things sure. that interface with the public. The public
Absolutely.
Doesn't go to chemical plants. And you really have your work cut out for you in improving the communication with the public about these hazards.
Sure.
All right, that's kind of depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough.
But you're excited about it
I
and hoping it. For more funding.
Absolutely. And I tell my students what you do impacts people's lives. Oftentimes sitting in a classroom, it's hard to imagine that. But having been to Haiti 12 times, I see
yes.
what happens when a building is built well versus when it's
right.
not built well.
Right.
And as an engineer, you can control that.
Right. All right. So, Reggie, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. And don't forget, Inside the Black Box is a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Our theme music is composed and written by Mill and Mary Hunt. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, but we want to welcome Eric Luckner as part of our engineering team.
Thank you very much. Right, I can't wait to join you guys later.
Will you be back?
Yes, I will be back.
That's good to hear. We haven't scared you off already.
No, not yet. In fact, I'm getting better. So.
All right. Thank you very much. And please join us next week for Inside the Black Box. Science, only funnier.